Facilities Division reduction in City Hall major maintenance for $10,000. And I'm really hoping you're going to cut the air hand dryers and never install them. And how much would that save? I will tell you why I'm asking that. The mayor and I had the honor of going to the International World Track and Field events at the convention center, and the nearest ladies' room had only those. And my hands have still not recovered from having blow drying for 4 days straight. So if you were thinking of putting air dryers in City Hall, please save the money. The paper towels are working quite nicely. Thank you.
Just a follow-up to Commissioner Fritch's question on the reduction in the prime contractor development, and it's directed to CBO. In your analysis, it says you acknowledge that the Bureau is not meeting its enrollment targets in the program, but suggest that there's no indication that this decision package will impact the Bureau's ability to meet enrollment targets in the future. What gives you that indication?
Well, we had asked for some performance measures around and just program goals, and so the dollars that were being cut from that program were technical assistance dollars, and in terms of getting contractors to enroll, I think right now they're not meeting their enrollment targets, and so really. The goal at this point is to really push to meet those enrollment targets. So I think that was specifically the performance measure that they were looking at was enrollment, not necessarily one that was around technical assistance. So
okay, so it won't impact their ability to meet the targets, but might it impact their ability to maintain those in the program because they're not getting the assistance they need to continue as in building their capacity?
And that's definitely a possibility. We were really looking just at specifically the goals of the program as stated were to increase enrollment. And so the decision to reduce technical assistance made sense. And, to reiterate Ken's point, these are tough cut decisions. And this was one that, we actually had very long discussions about. But ultimately, in light of citywide balancing, we needed to ultimately arrive at a balanced number. So this was one of the items that we did recommend reducing, but it's not one we would like to. So.
It's kind of difficult. I have a couple of questions, and it appears in your budget you talk about these things, so you get the questions. In regard to the Portland building, I know a percentage in that remodel, I guess for lack of a better word for it, that there's a certain percentage for equity, for your minorities, your women-owned business, your local hiring, et cetera, that's supposed to be targeted toward those groups. Is any consideration being done to... In local hiring, you're downtown, the Portland building's downtown. How far are you reaching out? Because a lot of our minorities that could use those jobs are way in East Portland. So what is being done so that East Portland, which has 25% of the population, gets some of those jobs?
I think that one's mine.
Okay.
We have in the RFP that probably is out by now, but may not, I mean, it's very close on the whole major construction, have, I think, the most aggressive minority women goals, not just in the aggregate, but also down to ethnicity for trades and so on that have to be met by the contractors. So we are doing that, which doesn't respond to where people come from. But we put aside the 1% then to somehow respond to community enhancements or opportunities. And we're open on that. And we can. And your point on East Portland is relevant. We're going to come back to the council in May with recommendations on how to spend the 1%, and hopefully then generate enough people who can fill those spots that we're demanding the contractor has on the job. So we're sensitive to East Portland issues. We have not yet developed the recommendations, but these will be in May.
Frida, can I just add one piece to that, since you've mentioned East Portland? one of my roles is liaison to the Regional Arts and Culture Council. One of the things we've been looking at is how can we more equitably distribute the benefits of the Percent for Art program to underserved parts of our community. The Percent for Art program generates money for public art, but there's a more often than not, the buildings that generate the Percent for Art are in the inner core. And it turns out there's nothing in the statute, authorizing statute, that prohibits us from investing the money outside of the catchment area around the building. So I've begun a conversation with Fred about, in this instance, taking a half of the Percent for Art money that's generated from this project and investing it in East Portland and doing some community art so that folks that may never see the benefit of having this building retrofitted downtown get to share in the dividend of a policy that says we are going to invest in public art, and we're working on that.
In talking about the goal, when you talk about the MBE or Emerging Small Business goal, is that disaggregated at all by MBE status and or WB status versus the aggregate ESB status?
Yes.
It is. Okay. Do we know what those numbers are?
If I had the RFP in front of me, I could tell you.
Okay. I do want to mention that Douglas did similar in with Fortis Construction with early childhood because we as a community also pressed to get locally and minority, and with the contractor's work, and it was extra work for that contractor, but he got 26%, which was pretty high, considering usually that isn't even looked at. I have another question, though, in regard to the data center, because that's in your budget, too, and the movement, and I don't know the history behind the movement and where it's going to move. It sounds like it's being recommended a separate specific facility be built for it. Is any consideration given for East Portland or even outer Southeast Portland for some of these? And I can understand the concentration where bureaus have to talk together and they're constantly meeting. It doesn't appear a data center is one where they always have to be downtown right in the mix of things, and it's less expensive out farther out than it is downtown.
We do not plan to have the data center downtown. We're going through the process to say where is it best located, but we have seismic concerns among others, and we don't want it downtown. We want to find some outlying area, and I don't know that we're going to build something because there are some people who have safe data centers where we could become one of the participants, but that depends on what the bids are. And I can't tell you where those are because we haven't got the proposals back.
Just making a suggestion. I know Gateway, there's some city property right in the transit center that's available, et cetera. And I know there's been the prior mayor push to get some services out more that way so that the those jobs are spread throughout the city.
Okay. I just think it's unlikely that we would build a building to do that. So I think the placement of the data center will be depending on where the vendors are that could take our equipment, which may well be in East Portland. I don't know.
Time to close this session and move on. Customary for the commissioner in charge to have some closing comments, but after a clean audit from Robert McAuliffe, I have nothing to say. Speaking of clean audits, for him, you'll have to make a deal.
Well, I've seen firsthand all the homes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and then the Bedmart stepped up on the VedMart stepped up and partnered with them on the homeless veterans. Just great, great work. Yep, great year. Okay, Auditor Caballero, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, community advisors, mayor, commissioners, bureau directors, and staff. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero. I am joined today by Chief Deputy Auditor Sarah Landis, and unfortunately, our Budget Advisory Committee representative, who was scheduled to come today, had some child care logistics and couldn't make it. So I'm sorry you won't be able to hear from her. And you already have been provided a lengthy handout in your notebooks. And we have a much shorter presentation today, and I've also provided some of the slides that we'll use today so you can follow along. Oops, that's not right. The Auditor's Office promotes transparency and accountability through eight divisions. You likely are familiar with the work of many of them, such as Audit Services, the Ombudsman's Office, Independent Police Review, City Archives and Records, and the Council Clerk. As the sixth elected official in Portland City Government, independence is critical to my ability to ensure the Auditor's Office carries out its mission. Protecting it is my top priority. As you may recall, we discussed the hearings office during last year's budget work session. It is an example of something that undermines the independence of my office, and I will spend a good bit of time today explaining why. The details are technical, but the big picture goal is to fix the way it is funded. City Council created the hearings office to give people a place to go to have their disputes with the city decided by an impartial officer. It's also where bureaus go to enforce provisions of the city code. The hearings office is how the city ensures due process for a variety of its actions. Organizationally, it has been in the auditor's office since 1991 to provide it with an independent home and administrative support. The administrative demand posed by the hearings office has become an unsustainable burden for the auditor's office. It disproportionately saps time from my chief deputy and the management services division compared to other functions in the auditor's office, which are core to our mission. Protecting the independence of my office fundamentally requires me to be able to manage my budget, and revenue for the hearings office is unmanageable. That's why it's necessary to move the hearings office from a cost recovery model to an overhead model. City financial policy says the overhead model is appropriate for functions that act in an oversight capacity or provide citywide benefits. The hearings office does both of those things. Without this change, I am prepared to exercise my charter authority and respectfully withdraw my consent to keep the hearings office. I did not come to that decision lightly, but it is the only way I can ensure delivery of the core functions of my office. So now let's dive into the details. I'm sorry, I keep going too fast. Okay. This is what the current funding model looks like. The light green at the top is revenue from outside agencies that pay to have cases heard by the hearings office. The light blue in the middle is revenue from the city's general fund. And the dark green at the bottom is revenue from city bureaus that pay the cost of hearings on a case-by-case basis. Predicting revenues from outside agencies and individual bureaus is nearly impossible, as this next slide illustrates. Among the cases heard by the hearings office are appeals when drivers think the police bureau or the Bureau of Transportation wrongfully towed their car. It also hears appeals by people who contend they were wrongfully kicked off of public transit. The volume of these cases varies depending on enforcement decisions at any given time, which makes it impossible to predict. What they have in common, as you can see, is a downward trend over the past 5 years. Revenues from vehicle tows is estimated to decrease 55% from the police bureau and 62% from transportation. Revenue from TriMet exclusions is estimated to be down 96% by next fiscal year. Meanwhile, other types of cases not funded on a per-cases basis are sometimes up and sometimes down. Just like the Fire and Rescue Bureau, the hearings office has to be ready to go when a request for service is received. whether caseloads are trending up or trending down at any given time. Best guess forecasts form the basis of agreements between the hearings office and other entities, and then the work is undertaken. Bills for payment must be calculated and tracked. When actual caseloads fall short of projections, other divisions in the auditor's office are in danger of subsidizing the fixed costs of the hearings office. From a management perspective, I cannot continue devoting the disproportionate share of staff resources needed to keep up the administrative load or hold back spending by other divisions in case revenues are needed, in case revenues fall short in the hearings office. My goal is to get out from under the forecasting, contracting, and billing, as well as the threat of subsidizing a function that is not core to the mission of the auditor's office. And let me turn back now to show you how I propose we fix the problem. I'm proposing moving fully to the general fund, which would mean about $302,000 up front. The light green bar to the right represents revenue from other sources that would be returned to the general fund if revenues exceed expenses. You should know that the budget office did not agree with my solution. As you can see, its response looks very much like the current model. It tinkers around with the flaws I've described, but it does not really address them. It also adds more administrative requirements. The budget office prioritizes protecting discretionary general funds over my responsibility to effectively manage the auditor's office. While I certainly understand the importance of protecting limited general fund dollars, I cannot abdicate my core responsibilities as auditor. The choice is not easy, but it's clear. Move the hearings office to an overhead model or find it another home that can absorb the administrative load and withstand the effects of unpredictable revenue.
Madam Auditor, just a question. If we shifted to an overhead model, have you or CBO calculated how that would be apportioned? And presumably, we'd have the option of either billing everybody on the theory that every bureau that has potential for an appeal would want to have a percentage, or we could tailor it so that the frequent flyers play a little bit more. Have you done that modeling?
The rest of the auditor's office is funded through the overhead model, and our current proportion is about 40% discretionary and 60% funded from bureaus that pay into the overhead model. So I'm assuming that were this moved into the overhead model, it would take the same shape. Having bureaus that use the hearings office pay proportionally more doesn't get us out of the path that we're on right now, which is forming interagency agreements and then doing all the workload tracking.
No, I get that. I guess all I'm saying is, maybe this is to CBO, I'd like to know what the different options under the overhead model would look like, including if you've got some frequent flyers that might pay a little bit more under the overhead model than just everyone getting dinged, and just to understand what those options are.
So right now, the overhead model, there's basically only one option, and that option is everybody's charged the same percentage or for the same, based on the same two allocation criteria, and those are the amount of positions they have basically and the size of their budget. So it doesn't matter the actual uses of the services by particular bureau, it's based on just the size of their budget and the number of FTEs they have compared to everyone else in the city, and that determines the portion that they would pay for these services.
Have you run those numbers so we could take a look at, under that formula, what it would look like?
Yeah, we could easily run them. It's going to be the same split, as Sarah said, that the rest of the bureau has. So with another $300,000, I mean, you're looking at, you know, it's going to be split roughly, you know, half and half between the general fund and then the paying bureaus.
Just as a point of clarity, I just want to make sure I understand. This is already in the overhead model. The general fund share that's paying for the hearings office runs to your normal overhead. So what you're asking for is additional general fund dollars to, you know, to diminish sort of the other revenues you're getting from other entities. But when you say to put it in the overhead model, I want to make sure I'm understanding. You're putting additional costs of the hearings office into the overhead model, but there's a portion of this that already is in the model, correct?
There is a portion. It's about half, a little bit less than half, but it's not just outside entities like TriMet. It's also land use and then growing caseload with city cases.
And now with my remaining time, I want to go over my two requests for additional resources and the cuts I proposed. The city's settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice requires more timely investigations of police misconduct complaints, as well as a larger caseload for the auditor's office staff to meet the terms of the settlement agreement, as well as recent changes in state law that broadened the definition of profiling and required that such complaints be investigated. We've asked for two additional investigators for the auditor's independent police review, and the budget office has recommended these additions. Our second request is for $20,000 to defray some of the increasing costs associated with a council requirement that online postings of video recorded meetings be closed captioned. The graphic shows that prior to 2013, captioning cost about $30,000, and it has jumped to about $55,000 since then. And we have absorbed these costs until now, but without additional funds, videos of council work sessions won't be captioned and therefore may not be readily accessible to the public. And the budget office has recommended against this request. And now I'll walk through our budget cuts. Our cuts totaled about $405,000. And it's not hard to think of the adage penny wise and pound foolish when considering these cuts. They mean fewer audits, less capacity for police misconduct investigations, and fewer options for me to carry out my responsibilities. It was tempting at the outside of this process to cut only our materials and services line items, but it is not a viable approach from an independent standpoint, and we couldn't get to the 5% threshold without cutting people. That's why there are two filled positions on our cut list. One is a support position in audit services, which will require the remaining staff to learn report production skills and take on more administrative duties for that division. We estimate this will increase the time it takes to complete an audit and therefore reduce the number of audits next year from 12 to 10. That in turn means a less efficient, less effective, and less equitable city government. The budget office recommended taking that cut. It did not, however, recommend cutting the annual community survey, which was included in that decision package. And by this calculation, we would keep the work but lose a person that we need to accomplish it. The second position is a senior management analyst in independent police review. This position is responsible for analyzing police misconduct data, producing periodic reports, and responding to ad hoc requests for information. These tasks will need to be reassigned to the remaining staff members, which eats into their capacity as complaint investigators, and the budget office recommended against taking this cut. Our final proposed cut is almost $84,000 in materials and services, and it's easy to think that no one will miss cuts like these, but I will. They reduce the flexibility I have to manage my office and increase the chances that I'll have to come back to those of you that we hold accountable and ask for more. And that's not where any auditor wants to or should be.
Just going to that a little bit more, given the budget office's analysis of over $250,000 for the last 5 years left in that bucket.
In the materials and services?
Yeah.
We have some cushion built into our materials and services to help the auditor's office retain some flexibility for decision making. And there's also functions in the auditor's office, like the Archives and Records Center, and what are some others that have?
There's some cushion built in for mandatory contracts, I think, is what has constituted a large portion of what our underspending in external materials and services has been. We have the Moss Adams external financial contract in our office, and that is often underspending the amount that we have set aside for it. I think that's the result of effective management rather than having too much money in the budget. So you see some places where we have a reserve, like, for example, the on-call hearings officer that we retain for land use hearings. Should our workload for our existing staff exceed our capacity to handle those hearings, or if there's a conflict. So we have to have the money there for the in reserve, but we don't always need it. And so reducing the total amount that we have to fund those contracts means that we would either not provide the service or have to come back each time and ask for an allocation from council to do so.
So did you put consider a realignment of shifting some of that money from external chosen service into personnel and short-term positions and such? I don't believe that there's enough there to do that, to salvage the position. Well, there's over $250,000.
That was
going to their analysis. I guess what I'm asking is, do you disagree with these numbers?
I don't disagree with the numbers, but I can tell you that for this year, we're on track to spend 90 to 95% of our external materials and services, so there wouldn't be that there to do.
Okay, thank you.
And so with that, I am ready to turn it over to Mr. Patton.
I'll just briefly go over the hearings office, our thinking about that a little bit. I think on the other packages, the auditors kind of explained where our recommendations come from, so I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. But just the thinking behind the hearings officer funding, what we try to do, it does look very similar when you look at the graphs compared to what the recommendations are, what the existing program, how it's funded, and how we've proposed it to be funded. The biggest difference basically is rather than looking at it throughout the year and trying to bill on a per case basis, we're trying to look at some sort of model where they can almost have a, based on either some sort of historical use or historical charges, have a fixed fee for the next year. So rather than trying to determine if they'll have the necessary funds based on the number of cases that come in, it's looking at, based on the number of cases you've used in prior years, we're going to charge you $80,000 to make sure that that service is available next year, whether you use that service or not. So that's kind of the basis of our recommendations, making sure that they have the funding available for the current year. It can be adjusted year after year depending on whatever metrics that we choose, but it does relieve that burden or that chance of not bringing in the necessary revenues and having to take from other programs in the Bureau. It's basically saying, for example, Bureau of Development Services, we're going to charge you X amount of money for next year, whether you use that amount of service or not. So,
would that suit? What are your concerns about that model?
My concerns about that are that the system that Jeremy describes also requires a lot of administrative caretaking. It requires fee studies. You'd have to be coming up with how much a case costs, and tow cases cost a different amount of money than other kinds of cases. And the hearings office staff would have to track their time. The hearings officers would have to track their time. We still have to do fee studies, as I understand it. And the administrative burden remains, and in some cases it increases under this arrangement.
I obviously don't know how this works, but it seems like the first time to pick the number, based on previous years, you pick the number, and then why would you have to track thereafter?
That was the recommendation that the budget office made, was that we consistently track the time it takes to do each case, each type of case, so that we have a basis for future. It's a level of time tracking that nobody else in the office does, and then no other legal services do.
So why did you make that recommendation?
Based on the cost of service principles, basically we want to charge the correct amount for the use of those services. And one of the other reasons not to put in the overhead model is if you look at it, for example, the land use reviews for BDS, you wouldn't want to necessarily put that into the overhead model, because when you put something in the overhead model, you're stating that it's a service that can be used by all bureaus, when we know particularly these fees are for particular things.
So yes, I understand why you're advocating not against that. I don't understand why you can't take the three bureaus that use the office the most, say, we are going to charge you $80,000, which was the number somebody mentioned, regardless of how many cases you send us. Why would they then have to track?
If there can be agreement between the bureaus about what that cost should be going into the future, then I think CBO would be okay with that.
Well, I think I probably have a dog or two in that fight, so we're willing to have that conversation. I mean, it does seem like the administrative burden outweighs the real benefit here. And if you can tweak an overhead model approach with the bureaus that are frequent flyers, that's what I was talking about, frequent flyers earlier, and I think I may be one of them, we're open to having that conversation. I have two questions for the auditor. The first is, what's been your experience to date with the new policy of waiving fees so that people have an easier opportunity to get a hearing?
The number of appeals have gone up slightly. I think that when we first proposed the code adjustments, we were worried about, you know, a rush to the hearings office, and that did not materialize. The centralizing the appeal filing in the hearings office, I think, is in continuing to get better and better as people know that that's what they're supposed to do. I think that the mix of cases that we're hearing in the hearings office on appeal has changed slightly, and I attribute some of that to the notification policy that bureaus are telling people they have a right of appeal, so we're seeing different kinds of cases.
That was the second of the three things I wanted to ask you. Are the bureaus consistently giving the notice that we're required to give?
No. And we had a training about a month ago where we brought in bureaus, and hearings officer Greg Frank went through some of the procedures that the hearings office has and what the expectations are in the code, and put the bureaus on notice that they will be there will be consequences as provided for in the code for not giving notice.
Is ultimately a question of getting compliance and uniformity across bureaus? Is that your concern, or should it be Fred Miller's concern?
It is a code requirement, so each bureau has.
But in terms of who is, I mean, Fred meets with the bureau directors monthly. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out who's best suited to ride herd on that.
That would not be me. That would be Fred.
And the final question I have is: I see that if you're required to take the audit services cut, you'd have to cut back on two audits.
Right.
Seems pretty dire. My view on this would be influenced, of course, by which audits you would have to cut. So if you could just supply that to me in writing afterwards.
I'm just intrigued by this tracking because of the hearings officer. When CBO is recommending they track their time, do they have the tool that makes it easy to track their time? I administrated a consulting services where that is just common practice because we work on multiple projects. In this case, yours would be multiple hearings and stuff. But we had electronically online that made it simpler. And in their case, they literally had to make notes, where in this case, I know some agencies, various agencies, they just have to plug it in, say, I'm working on, say, in this case, land use or whatever. Are you providing them with, are they being provided with a tool if you want them to track it so it makes it real easy to track it? It's not as onerous as people think because I've done it myself, but it seems like they should have a very easy tool to do it if that's what's required of them.
The city's payroll system allows for employees to track time between different projects.
But it doesn't allow it to track it by case, and it's a paper and pencil operation. We're in the process of changing out the software and getting new case management software in the hearings office. But right now, it's the clerks write down when a case starts and when it finishes it, and then it gets handed off to the hearings office. And there's also time built in for writing a decision. And it just is a lot of having to remember when you started doing something and when you didn't, and writing it in the file.
It seems to me this might be a test. If they didn't have to track what they were sending you, they just agree to the 25 or 60,000, you don't have to track it, and then the commissioner in charge works with the auditor if they think that the
membership.
Well, then we could make adjustments to a bump or something. I mean, because I
and land use was not included in the in our proposal. That was one of the external revenues for that reason.
I think we can find a solution.
Do you have some other thoughts in addition to that?
Yeah, one besides hating billable hours, having had to do them. An overall comment that strikes me as I sit here, and you know, Commissioner Fish jokes about it, but the idea that the watchdog for the city on behalf of the community is having to balance its core mission of doing that, which then often is a critique of those of you who are supposed to fund the office, just seems a little out of whack to me. And specifically talking about, as I mentioned, the disability issues, the idea that something may not be captioned because she can no longer, or this office can no longer fund that based upon all of the other issues going on, I think is again, a reflection on what are we considering as important in terms of disability and how we address it. I'm struck by the irony overall of this conversation in the first place, that the elected office has to come and ask the other elected office for money, as well as put up cuts that I don't think any of you had to do. So it's just striking me different.
I don't have staff of 50 in my office, so there's that. I wanted to just push back a little bit on the comments about the money for the captioning. In my bureaus, we prioritize our external materials and service money for doing the things that are most equitable. So I hear that there's a lot, $250,000 isn't here, has been used this year for good purposes. So I'd be interested to know how close to zeroing out your external materials and services are, because that to me is an external materials and service, and why would it need extra money when it's a core function?
We have been absorbing that cost as it's been going along, and at some point we need to come back to you and remind you that we're absorbing it. There are, you know, 8 functions in the auditor's office, and so I think that the council clerks are an administrative body essentially for your council meetings and your work sessions, and so we are coming back to bring that to your attention, that that's something that's growing and we've been absorbing it, and that there at some point will become a consequence for continued increases, and I just can't let those go unabated.
I want to two quick points. Are we clear, CBO, as to what options the council, you're going to give to the council to explore this new model? That's it. Yes? Okay. And I wasn't clear, so I just want to make sure you're clear. And I just want to respond to Dante for a second, because I think you're raising almost 2 questions. So one is, you know, the propriety of having 5 elected officials pass judgment on the budget of a 6th elected official that has no vote on the budget. And that is an interesting structural question. And I just was looking over the Constitution of the United States the other day in anticipation of being grilled by some Grant High School students. And I was reminded that there's a provision in the Constitution that says the Congress may not, during a president's term, raise or lower his or her salary, precisely because the founders anticipated that you could use that to punish, cut the president's salary because you disagree on a matter or what have you. But here I'm going to just make a distinction. Because the auditor's office receives general fund money, they and every bureau need to show a 5% cut, because we've said we're going to do this exercise. And I think I'm increasingly in a minority on this. But then I'm in good company, because you were the one who launched it, and I still think it was the right thing to do, was this exercise of modified zero-based budget. I mean, of course we're not going to take a cut that reduces the ability to do audits of us. I mean, it's not good policy, and it would look horrible in a headline. But we are going to have the conversation with every bureau that gets general fund money. If the sky fell tomorrow, how would you absorb a 5% cut? And I, for one, continue to find this conversation useful. Painful, yes. And no, aggravating, yes. Our budget advisory committees hate it. I get all that. But I applaud the mayor in his first year by putting us through this exercise, because I do think it not only educates us about potential trade-offs and how pain might be apportioned, but every once in a while, I think it's going to produce a little nugget that's going to allow us to do our work more efficiently. That's the goal. And so I'm going to beat that dead horse.
Auditor, I think we have to bring this to a close. Anything in closing that you'd like to add?
No, I'd just like to say that I appreciate Mr. James bringing that up, because that's something that I'm going to be working on in the coming year as I work on some of these independence issues. And I would say to Commissioner Fish that it would be, it sounds a little bit like a good academic exercise, but I think that if there were more integrity in the process, it would be a more useful process. But for me, going through that, and certainly our budget advisory committee wrestled with these things about whether I should put any cuts up or whether I should not put cuts up, because it is a situation where the 6th elected official in this government you know, comes before you to put cuts up, and you are exempted from those cuts. And so there was a lot of wrestling around with some of these issues. And so I think if the process was more predictable, if when you put budget guidance out, the expectation is that you're going to comply with the budget guidance, I think that would make it easier for us to participate in the process. But it didn't feel like that when we were wrestling around and having to go to people and say, I'm sorry, but I have to put your job up in a budget cut.
Saying that even though we're required to show a 5% cut with general fund bureaus, you're saying not with our offices. Is that your point? Because every general fund bureau has had to come in and show a 5% cut. So
right.
What's when you say it doesn't have integrity, that gets my attention. What's the part that doesn't have integrity?
I felt like the process where the guidance came out, it said that there were supposed to be 5% cuts to the general fund, and it immediately seemed as though there were conversations going on that were contradicting that guidance. And it put my budget advisory committee and my office in a difficult position of appearing to look like we were horse trading, your auditor should not be horse trading, or putting cuts up when other people weren't. It was just a really difficult process.
This is an enormously important question, but I'm going to, either it's because I didn't sleep well last night or because we're so far deep into the budget I'm beginning to lose brain power. But I honestly don't understand what you're saying, and it may be my own deficiency. So let's make sure we have this conversation.
Okay.
You meet with all of us. I'm unaware of where the auditor's office, which is like a bureau, is being treated differently than any other bureau that has a general fund component, other than the fact that the budget guidance memo said that we may hold housing harmless because of the emergency. But I want to understand the point you're making. And I'm for some reason, I'm falling short. I'm not understanding it.
And I would agree that somewhere along the line, the auditor's office has come to be treated like a bureau. And the auditor's office is an elective office just like yours. And we have charter mandated requirements to carry out, and I have responsibilities as an elected official. I am answerable only to the public. And so I agree with you that it is confusing. I think the lines have gotten blurred, and that's why in the coming year this is going to be my top priority, is to brighten those lines again and to get an understanding through this process and just in our meetings about treating the auditor's office like an elective office and not like a bureau.
So I'm all ears, and I look forward to having that conversation. I think, based on what you just said, now I think I have a better understanding. I would simply push back and say I'm not sure that's a question of integrity. It may be a question of different views, history, practice. There have been other auditors that preceded you. Integrity is a big word. I think it's a conversation we can have that's maybe less loaded. And and I'm certainly very interested in knowing your view on this and how we might do things better or differently.
When I used the word integrity, I was talking about the budget process. That when guidance is laid out, that there should be an expectation that it's going to be followed. And I felt like we were following it, and other people weren't. So it got very confusing right off the bat. So
I'm sorry you were confused, but there was an expectation, and I expected it to be followed by everyone. And with that, I think we do need to move on.
May I just make one statement for the record? First of all, Commissioner Novick and I are very aware that we are only accountable to the public also, since we'll be on the ballot in May. So we also take that very seriously, all of us. And secondly, that I have committed to returning at least 5% of my budget next year and ongoing, and have every year so far. So I agree that guidance did not apply to the elected's office, but for me and my house, we will give 5% back.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on to the city attorney.
Good afternoon, Citizen Advisors, Council, Mayor Hales, everybody else. I'm Tracy Reeve. I'm the Portland City Attorney, and with me is Christine Jividen, who's the City Attorney's Office Business Operations Supervisor. And I wanted to just touch briefly on the most significant issues that may affect our office over the next 5 years. We have a number of senior, highly experienced attorneys who will be retiring in the next 5 years, so succession planning is one of the challenges that we face. I know we're not alone in that in the city, but it does present budget challenges as well, since we can't bring the replacements on before those senior attorneys retire, and trying to figure out how we're going to develop that expertise and have it in place as we see, and the next 5 years really are going to be crucial. I have a huge brain drain happening in the next 5 years. So that's a major issue for us, and we are continuing to work on it. A key focus of our office the past couple of years and going forward is to increase the amount of sort of affirmative and proactive work we're doing. A lot of people think of lawyers as being defensive and risk preventative, and those are all very important things that we do and will continue to do. But we are also trying to look at ways that we can affirmatively work to support city policies and not merely be risk avoidant. And some examples are that we are increasingly using affirmative litigation, meaning litigation that we file on behalf of the city and not just cases that we defend, to increase the collections for the city. The Expedia case brought in $1.9 million this year net. We, as you know, you just authorized us, and we will be filing the Monsanto case to hold Monsanto accountable for costs that the city's incurred dealing with PCB contamination. We, over the past year, have developed and reinstituted a civil forfeiture program working with the police bureau that has community benefits in that it takes the profit out of some criminal activities, also secures revenue both for public safety, and we are able to get awarded out of those civil forfeiture proceeds some fees for the work we do, and I'm going to touch on that again in a bit, because in order to reduce burden on general fund for asking for a paralegal position to be added, we're proposing to use those revenues that we're bringing in through our affirmative civil forfeiture litigation. We are continuing to have an express focus on civil rights and equity work. Last year, you funded an attorney to work on those issues, and she has been very, very busy. I could use more, although I'm certainly not asking for more this year, at least. Some of the notable accomplishments in the past year have been the work to support the council's passage of legislation to give returning citizens a fair shot at employment. That'll take effect July 1. We're working hard at this point on implementation and outreach and training and administrative rules that we'll be bringing back before you. That attorney has also worked hard recently to develop training for boards and commissions. We realized that we were lacking some training for boards and commissions in a variety of areas. That's not fair to our civic volunteers who are working on these city boards and commissions and may not have received adequate training over time. And our next heavy lift in that area is going to be to come to you and propose that we look at a more uniform structure for bylaws and for how people are appointed and how people are removed should that become necessary, because we have a lot going on and it's kind of all over the place, and some recent issues that have arisen have shown us that there is not any uniformity. And while each of those boards and commissions is going to need obviously some flexibility and some differences, we think that there could be more equity and uniformity if we had a base template that boards and commissions worked off of in terms of rules and bylaws and that sort of thing. Our attorneys have been actively working on equity in housing, the housing emergency, a variety of affordable housing projects and legislation, and will continue to do so. Work on gender neutral restrooms and other issues pertaining to transgender and gender nonconforming Portlanders and employees. And as I had the opportunity to mention to you yesterday, we recently co-hosted with the Office of Equity and Human Rights and the Governing Alliance for Racial Equity a two-day conference for attorneys to focus on how government attorneys can advance racial equity. We're looking forward in the coming year to more citywide trainings on a number of issues, including legal protections and resources available for employees and community members with mental illness. That's something that we've talked with the Bureau of Human Resources about doing. We're engaged in conversations with the Office of Equity and Human Rights about how we can further training, education, and enforcement of our Title VI plan and our complaint processes. And all of these are areas that require resources. And so over the next few years, as we continue to emphasize this affirmative work as well as our defensive work on behalf of the city, you know, to continue to do that will require resources. So staffing is one of the challenges we have to achieving some of our objectives. In addition, we face challenges, you know, we work very hard on our timeliness and reviewing documents and contracts, but we do a lot of that, and that's not, we're not quite as timely as we would like to be on that purely because of staffing issues. We have rededicated staff resources internally in the last year, reassigning a litigation paralegal to work full-time over the past year on our legal records management program. As you know, our public records system, GovQA, has now gone live, and we're continuing to support that. We're handling many more public records requests than we did historically. For that reason, we desperately, and other reasons, we desperately need additional support staff, and we would ask that you look positively on our first decision package, which is AT01. That's the where we're proposing to hire an additional paralegal, and we would realign resources from the civil forfeiture program so that it would be neutral to the general fund. We'd also ask that you consider whether it's necessary to cut our applications analyst position, which is decision package AT03. We understand the need to dedicate additional resources to the housing emergency. We certainly support that and recognize that it is a real need, but the loss of this position will negatively affect our ability to continue several ongoing projects, namely, and in specifically, one of the things that we've started working on is pushing out more resources on our website for internal city employees to be able to access some legal resources. That's true with GovQ&A. We've done it recently with trademarks and copyrights and some rules and processes there. We think that that's a fertile area where we can do more with less, if you will. But if we lose our applications analyst position, that will likely be deferred. Because other staff will have to absorb a lot of that IT work that is currently being done by that position. The other way that it will have a negative impact on our office is that it will necessarily, some of the IT work that is being done by that position will likely fall on the paralegal position that's supporting the legal records management program, because a lot of that is technological, so it will be a hit there. Again, we do understand that there is a need to find cuts and additional resources. One thing we would ask is if you do feel it's necessary to make that cut this year, that there be consideration to it not necessarily being permanent. And finally, we believe we can absorb the materials and services cut reflected in decision package AT02, and we're happy to tighten our belts there, again, in recognition of Council's priorities and where those funds are going. I want to leave time to respond to any questions and concerns you have, so I'll stop here. And we do intend to come before you with a report on the City Attorney's Office work and activities early in fiscal year 16-17 to give you more detail.
Good afternoon, Jay Marie Ford, City Budget Office. I'll keep my comments brief. CBO did recommend in favor of the three identified cut packages to reach the 5% general fund reduction. With the two of the cut packages, we did not recommend in favor of cutting the requested paralegal position, which is a cost-effective way of increasing the office's capacity without additional general fund resources or new attorney positions. The position is also expected to contribute to continued positive performance trends in the office.
Question, Mayor.
Did recommend the technology support position to be cut.
We did. The Bureau indicated that it could reassign some of that work to existing support staff if the new paralegal position is approved, though some of the technology needs would need to be, potentially need to be utilized through external contracts. So recognizing it may hit the Bureau, in taking a citywide approach, that it did seem to be a cut that they could absorb, at least for this year.
I'm going to keep saying that we need more paralegals until we have a lot more paralegals.
So I have a question, and first I want to just state my bias. Through happenstance, I am now effectively managing the two largest pieces of litigation facing the city, and through a quirk of my Bureau assignments, I seem to have the lion's share of some of the newest stuff, and certainly a heavy dose of public records on an ongoing basis and related things. So I'm a big consumer of legal services, and I'm not saying that to whine. I'm teeing it up for the question, which is, it just feels like the volume is growing pretty significantly, not just because of a more aggressive use of public records laws to get documents pre-litigation and during litigation, but also a more aggressive legal approach generally challenging government actions, big and small. And so between Anderson and Superfund, those are the top two cases the city has got against us. They're not going away anytime soon, and they keep becoming more, not less, complicated. So the question I have for you is, how do we gauge what is a right-sized office to deal with the volume of work? And number two, how do we know that we have the right ratio of paralegals to lawyers? And one of my own views is that we could use more paralegals. Because while, you know, from time to time we need an experienced lawyer to come in and offer an opinion, and we need people to go into court and argue the motions and file the briefs, there's a lot of work that has to be done with offices, pulling together documents, reviewing documents, things like that. And that's uniquely what a highly trained paralegal can help with. So just briefly, comments about what is a right-sized office, and what is the right ratio of paralegals to lawyers?
I don't know exactly per number what's the right ratio of paralegals to lawyers, but I do know that we're understaffed with paralegals right now. We could do a lot more paralegal work, and paralegals are very highly skilled legal professionals, and there's a lot of stuff that they can do that, in the absence of paralegals available to do that, some of our more junior attorneys or even more senior attorneys end up doing. As to how do we know if we're right-sized or not, I would say that we know we're not right-sized if we get to a point where we don't feel like we can competently handle the vast bulk of the city's work in-house, and we're starting to need to go to outside counsel for capacity issues. And we're not at that point yet. But I would say that many of the things that I'm talking about are very cost-effective. I mean, having attorneys, you know, if we have to defend a case, if we have to defend the Superfund case or the Anderson case, or if we're going to go file a number of collection actions, well, we have to defend those cases. That's going to be our first priority. So sometimes even affirmative litigation that would bring revenues into the city, we're not undertaking because of capacity issues. And so we are at the point where we know we could do more affirmative litigation and bring in more revenue to the city if we have more resources to do that, particularly paralegal resources, because some of the more routine collection actions, it's not rocket science to do the complaints and the filing. You do need an attorney's involvement, obviously, but a paralegal can do a lot of that day-to-day work. So I guess it's a bit more of an art than a science, knowing when we're right-sized.
Well, and you know, there's a consequence to not getting the right balance, which is turnaround times that are not as responsive as a client might like, or difficult, you know, just robbing Peter to pay Paul with things in your office. I'm struck by the volume of work, how time sensitive it is, and how demanding your clients are, us and the bureaus. And I fear that you're getting close to not having adequate resources to meet the demands. And it isn't something where we can just keep adding something in your basket, because there's a cost. And one of the things that you and I have talked about is that in cases where there's an intense amount of work and a big demand, you know, I've asked you to let me know when do you need to have some additional support, you know, whether it's a paralegal or something else. And I want us to be nimble enough to be able to make those decisions off budget cycle if necessary, because the work doesn't stop.
Right.
And this is work that's timely and has a political dimension, and it's got to get done. And I just want to acknowledge that you have a lot of hardworking people that my impression is that we're spread very thin right now. And I'm not saying that just as an advertisement for your budget. There's a consequence if we